The Pat Kenny Show
on News Talk with Mastercard.
My next guest was born and raised in a small town in upstate New York, and in 2011 became the youngest woman to ever assume the office of Deputy Chief of Staff to the US President. Her love of politics started when she spent a summer interning with Bernie Sanders. She then went on to work for both John Kerry and Barack Obama. She's now written a book about her career in politics. The book is called Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? And Other Questions You Should Have Answers To When You Work in the White House. Alisa Mastromonaco is on the line now. Alisa, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, we should start with the title of your book. Who thought this was a good idea? Because
Yes. It
really tells us an awful lot about what is contained between the covers.
Yeah, so, you know, they say that when you write a book, it is so much better if you know the title. And the title actually inspired the whole book because it is based off of emails that I would get from Barack Obama or one of the two gentlemen that would travel with him when they were upset with something I decided they should do, because I would get an email and it would say, the subject line was always, hey there, and then you'd open it up and it would say, who thought this was a good idea, when they knew very well that I was the one who had thought it was a good idea. And so it just seemed to encapsulate, you know, all of my time in the White House and even growing up.
The first time we come across this in the book is when you have scheduled a speech for Barack Obama in a place called Chester, and
Yes. Snow
is forecast, but it actually turned out to be a little bit worse than that.
Indeed, it was. So President Obama, as most people know, is from Hawaii. He likes warm climates. He does not like the snow or the cold. But it was about 10 days, 12 days before the election, and he was in Pennsylvania along with John McCain. And there was snow forecast. The event was outside because you want big venues so they can accommodate anybody who wants to come. And I went into the campaign manager, David Plouffe, that morning. I said, Plouffe, it's snowing. The event's outside. You know, John McCain is canceling all of his events. Should we keep Chester? And he said, well, what do you think? And I said, well, of course we should keep Chester. So I send a note to the team in Chester. I say, we're keeping it. Go forward. And they said, oh, my goodness. And so Barack Obama takes stage, and instead of snow, which can be quite gentle and beautiful, he was being slapped in the face with ice and sleet. And I was at my desk, and my deputy, Danielle, said, oh, no, oh, no. And we looked at the TV, and he was soaking wet. And as he concluded his remarks, he put his hand out, and his aide, Reggie, gave him his phone. And 2 seconds later, my phone rang. And I knew it was him. I knew his number. I put my head down on the desk to sort of gird myself. And he says, Alisa? I say, hi, sir. He says, it's Obama. Where are you right now? And I said, I'm at my desk. And he said, must be nice. And he hung up on me. But the best part of that story is that about 6 or 7 months later, the photograph that was the front page, I think, of the Washington Post or New York Times, of him being smacked in the face with sleet, which showed him working for every single vote, won the Pulitzer. And so when that photo won the Pulitzer and we were on Marine One together, and I said, oh, you know, look, it's Chester, Pennsylvania. And he said, I must have been quite proud of myself, but to still never put him in sleet again.
Now, the book is very, from your point of view, very self-deprecating, even though you were extremely young when you got the job, which you did in the White House, which is a hugely responsible job. But there are obviously principal characters in the book. POTUS himself is, he runs right through it. But also, as well as yourself, there's another character to me anyway, reading it, and that's your body.
Yes.
Your body, you discuss it almost as if it's a third party, whether it's fatter or thinner than it should be, whether it's suffering from irritable bowel syndrome at any given point, whether it's searching for a tampon, or whether it's grinding its wisdom teeth to dust.
Yes. It in some ways, I mean, I think in every life, our body is the third character, and it makes you have to be, you know, quite vulnerable to discuss things like that. And I really wanted a book that would relate to young people, I mean, especially women, but young people generally from like 15 to 30. And so I felt that in telling this story, I wanted to tell the good, the bad, and the ugly, because I think that too many of the political, you know, memoirs, and I didn't really want this to be a memoir per se, they gloss over our imperfections, and they make what we have achieved seem very unachievable for people. And so I thought that, you know, for the purposes of this book, which was geared towards a younger audience, it was written in my voice. It's not stodgy or you know, too esoteric. I wanted to tell everyone that I struggled, that I needed to share my sort of challenges with my friends, because I couldn't have gotten through some of these situations without them. And so, yes, whether it was tampons or irritable bowel syndrome, you know, there's a fantastic photo I have of myself and my friend Dan Pfeiffer, who most people know. And we were on a very hot boat in Senegal, and he knew that the heat could trigger my IBS, which a lot of people don't know. And he kept fanning me. He was fanning me with his briefing book, and he said, "Buddy, are you okay? You're going to make it." And that's the upside. You know, I didn't feel alone. I wasn't stressing, because stress can make things, when you have, you know, IBS, much, much worse. And so I never regretted it, and I'm really glad that I shared it with everybody.
At the same time, being in the Vatican, about to meet the Pope, when your tummy starts to act up, that is very challenging.
That was terrible. Yes, that was very challenging. And I had a woman who had worked with me and who lived with me for a couple of years was on the trip, and we were sitting down to breakfast, and I had gotten some scrambled eggs. And she looked at me and she's like, "What did you do? Why are you eating scrambled eggs?" Because sometimes they can upset my stomach. But when you're on a foreign trip, what people don't know is that unless you are in the luncheon with the president and prime minister, for example, you don't necessarily eat. And so sometimes it's catch as catch can when it comes to meals. And so I did not know when I was going to eat that day. And so I had some scrambled eggs, which in fact set my stomach on fire as we were walking into the, you know, unspeakable beauty of the Vatican. And you thought that maybe I would have been overwhelmed by the beauty, but instead I was focusing on the fact that, you know, as we jokingly say, I didn't want to poop on the Pope. But again, having everybody know that I suffered from this, you know, the White House doctor, Dr. Jackson, you know, sprung to action. He knew that he had to get me some medicine, and he did, and they couldn't find water. And to this day, we laugh because one of the young staff members finally came in with a cup of water, and we're in the Vatican. We're like, "Where did you get this water?" So maybe it was the holy water that blessed my stomach, but I got to meet the Pope, and I did not poop on him.
And now you've been to so many places with the president, and one of the places that you reveal you really wanted to be and the person you really wanted to meet was the person who lives there. That's Buckingham Palace. And Queen Elizabeth II.
Yes. So growing up, my family is from Germany and Italy, and my German grandmother, my Oma, she would get all of her German magazines delivered when we were young, and she would point out and tell me stories about all of the royals. And so I grew to have this deep, deep sort of infatuation with the Queen and the royals and, you know, Buckingham Palace. And everybody in the White House knew about it. And so when we were getting ready to go to London for the Queen's Jubilee, everybody was sort of watching me. They're like, "Alyssa, don't lurch at the Queen. Like, don't embarrass us. Don't cause an international incident." And so we hosted dinner for the Queen at Winfield House, which is the U.S. Embassy in the U.K. And we said, you know, I was quite appropriate. She looked so stunning. She was in a sequin gown. She had a tiara on. And as I was going through the receiving line to shake her hand, the president and the first lady were looking at me like, "Don't embarrass us, Alyssa." And I didn't. I was proper. I was wonderful. So excited. The next morning, we're getting ready to leave. And the president and first lady were leaving from Buckingham Palace on Marine One from the lawn, which is, you know, so fantastic. And we were leaving. The rest of the staff were taking buses to the airport because we can't all fit. And the president's aide, Reggie, comes and knocks on my door, and he says, "Boss, the boss wants you on Marine One with him." And the funny thing is, the Obamas are very casual. They were very casual people. And so if the staff were going home, basically, and would not be seen by the press boarding the plane, they were very fine with us being casual, you know, jeans and a blazer. So I, in fact, was in jeans and a blazer, and my bags were already on Air Force One. And so I had to ride to Buckingham in my jeans, and I thought maybe I'd stay in the car, but they said, "No, you're going on Marine One." So I walk into Buckingham. I was so nervous. I stood behind a credenza the whole time, pretending to read magazines. And finally, we're getting ready, all of the service staff and the workforce at Buckingham are lined up outside to wave goodbye. And we walk across the lawn, and I was asking the valets that take care of the president's personal belongings. I said, please, will you give me a bag to carry? But they're members of the military, and they said, no, ma'am, we're absolutely not giving you a bag to carry. And so I tried to hustle across the lawn with no one taking notice of my jeans to get on Marine One, have the president turn around and look at me and just say, jeans, Alyssa, jeans at Buckingham Palace. And the worst part was then he did a double take, and he said, what is in your hands? I had accidentally stolen a Tatler magazine from the magazine table when I was too preoccupied to notice. And so there I was in jeans with Buckingham's Tatler on my lap on Marine One. And I was certain that they would never take me any place important ever again. Mm-hmm.
I hope you still have that magazine.
It is. It's somewhere in my storage boxes. It definitely is.
Now you cut your teeth in politics with Bernie Sanders, you know, who at the time you were cutting your teeth with him, he wasn't that well known. Of course, he's much more celebrated now for contesting Hillary Clinton for the nomination.
Yes.
What was that like?
So it was very interesting because he was always a bit well known because back when I was in college in the mid-90s, he was the only independent in the House of Representatives. And so he was in his office, was a few blocks from my dormitory. And I had decided that I wanted to stay in Burlington, Vermont for the summer. My parents said, if you want to stay, you must get a job. And so I applied for several jobs, including an internship, because I thought it would be good for me. And lo and behold, I did not know the front row experience that I would be getting because they found me enjoyable. You know, they didn't mind the staff and Senator and Congressman Sanders at the time. They gave me a lot of access because I guess I handled the access well. And so I would drive Bernie to events. I would pick him up at the airport sometimes. And he would read the newspaper when we were driving around, and he would quiz me on the news of the day. And we stayed in touch after I left. I went to Washington the next summer for an internship in his Washington office. And then over the years, his office and I, we just always stayed in touch. But the reason that I so enjoyed how he ran his campaign is that knowing him back, you know, in the 90s, he did not change. He was the same person that took stage every day that I remembered in my car, you know, driving to the airport. And I think that that's so important in politics because to me it's, you know, I didn't really worry what would happen if he ascended to a higher position because I knew that he was at least always sort of true to himself and that he had a moral compass.
So were you a Bernie fan or a Hillary fan because you had served with Hillary as she was Secretary of State for Barack Obama? So you must have been somewhat torn.
My position was that I would help anybody running to be the Democratic nominee. So if Bernie asked me for help, I would help them. If the Clinton people asked for help, I would help them. You know, I'm a pretty discreet and sort of judicious person, and so I never would have revealed secrets to the other. But I did not come out and publicly support anybody because, you know, also as a former Obama official, for me personally, I wanted to wait and see if Vice President Biden, who I love dearly, was going to decide to run. And you know, he didn't officially pull out until I think the fall of 14, 13, whenever 15, whatever year it was. So you know, and if he had run, I think a lot of us would have. I mean, he's our guy. You know, we sat next to him every day. So to me, I thought they were all highly qualified. But of course, I have a special place in my heart for Bernie since he gave me he was my one and only resume builder back when I was, you know, 22.
Much of the early part of the book, or a lot of it, is about the John Kerry presidential campaign. And what comes across is the total exhaustion that's involved for the candidates, the families, and all of those around them. I mean, at one point, you have to delay everything by 24 hours because people literally cannot stand up.
Yes, and it was so many of the lessons that I learned from, well, let's just say I learned many lessons from my time on the Kerry campaign in that, you know, people are human and there is only so much even the most aggressive campaigner can endure. And the other thing that we learn is that when you let people get too tired, they just make mistakes. You know, it's the law of diminishing returns. The more that you push, sort of the less good they are at the events and persuasive. And super low energy. But yes, on that trip, we did, let me see if I can remember it. We did 52 cities in 17 days.
Wow.
On bus, boat, and train. I think that's right, bus, boat, and train. With John Kerry and his family and John Edwards, and at some point, I think in St. Louis, they split, and John Edwards took one path, and we took the other. But, you know, for all of us, I think that you assume that you can get through it. It's only 2 years, you know, of a campaign, but they are very long years. And the thing that is interesting is that it's not just the amount of time that you work, it's the intensity. It's the intensity that can make you just need to, you know, lay down and take a Xanax and shut off for 2 days, but you can't do that. And so for me, I know now, having been through that for so many years, that, you know, even my body has aged ahead of schedule.
Yeah.
And so I try to be much nicer to my body now. And, you know, in work, we'll probably try to be as lazy as possible from now until I retire.
Okay. Now, that's interesting that you talk about in the book about the aging of your body, because
yes.
Fertility is something that impinges on many women's lives who mm-hmm. do at some point think about having a family. And you were prompted to go for what's called an AMH test, which indicates
yes.
the number of eggs you have left and mm-hmm. how likely you are to conceive. Tell me about that, because it wasn't that you were particularly anxious to have a baby tomorrow or anything like that, but you wanted to know.
No, I wanted to know. I had read several articles, and this is sort of going back to maybe 2010, I guess, yeah, probably 2010 when I had the test. And it was when everyone had been talking about egg freezing, and someone had approached me and said, have you thought about freezing your eggs? And so I started doing research, and I found out that one, especially at that point, I mean, even in 7 years, technology has come a very, very far distance. But I said, oh, I'm not going to freeze my eggs. But it got me thinking, like, oh, I wonder what my state of affairs is in my womb. And so I asked my doctor to give me an AMH test, which was the most sort of reliable, it's a pretty reliable test. And I think it's a scale of 0 to 7. And my number came back 0.2, which meant maybe I had, you know, 1 or 2 eggs left. And on the one hand, I was sad, but because it was something that so preoccupied me, I mean, I probably thought about it every day, you know, sort of my state of fertility. It's weird, but, you know, it's like you get your period, you use a tampon, you can't help but think about, you know, whether or not you're fertile, I guess. But no, and so I just had to make peace with it, because I'm like, there are so many other ways to have a family. There are so many different types of families. So it kind of freed me in a way. I don't know that if I had not been in the White House, which is so, you know, preoccupying unto itself, that I would have felt the same way. But getting that information at that period of my life, I was able to sort of digest it fairly well.
And there's a story in the book about sitting beside a diplomat and having conversation, and he's talking about his children, three
yeah.
boys and a girl, and he tells you all about the careers of the boys and how they're doing and so on, and doesn't mention the girl.
He didn't. And, you know, one of the things that I prided myself on always is that I would find out who I was sitting next to at a state dinner, and I would do, you know, research on them. Everything from, you know, the booming tourism in their country to personal facts that, you know, might be interesting to talk about. And so he told me about his sons, and then I mentioned his daughter, and he said, well, you know her, she's 30 years old and unmarried. She is an old maid.
Mm.
And I did not have a wedding ring. I didn't have any rings on. I had one ring on, and I moved it to the hand where you would be married. I had to put it on my left ring finger so that he would think I was not an old maid, even though who cared? I was sitting next to, you know, commerce secretary of whatever country it was, and that should have been good enough. But no, the only my immediate trigger was like, oh, I don't want him to think I'm an old maid, because I was older than his daughter at the time by quite a few years.
And what strikes me too about your book is the mixture of glamour and crisis, you know, state dinners and set pieces, which are very impressive. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, on the other hand, you have a crisis going on that the public know nothing about. I mean, you were talking about the demise of Mubarak and trying to get U.S. citizens out of Cairo while there's a karaoke party to go to.
Yes. Yes. That was, you know, the thing that I think is so, that I think is concerning about the current administration, but was well set in our administration, because we took very seriously the advice and counsel of the Bush administration when we were transitioning. And the most important thing they said was, everybody needs to know their roles and responsibilities. And when you know your role and responsibility, when a crisis arises, the government doesn't come to a screeching halt. You know, it's not like the kids around a soccer ball where everybody goes to the ball. You focus on what you have to do, and everybody else keeps everything else moving. And so, yes, when I first became deputy chief, it was, I think, Robert Gibbs was leaving as White House press secretary, and there was a party, and there was karaoke, and it was very reasonable for there to be a party because nobody else needed to be involved in what I was doing. I was working on it with a different group of people. And so once we handled it and we got the plane and the citizens from Illinois back home to Illinois, I went and did karaoke.
Well, the toll that the working in the White House, and it clearly someone with your heavy responsibilities, it mm-hmm. takes a bigger toll on those with lesser responsibilities. But waking up one morning with a mouth full of blood.
Yes, that was the Kerry campaign. And we had been working. It was during the tour across America, 52 cities in 17 days. And we were basically working around the clock. I had had terrible tooth pain, you know, a week or so prior, and ignored it. I took a lot of Advil. Don't do that. That's a terrible idea. I ignored it. And then one day I woke up and I had a mouthful of blood. And it was because my tooth had shattered in the back and there was a shard of it. And it had cut my tongue. And that's why I was bleeding. And so, of course, you know, I still went to work. I showed up at work. And I actually called John Kerry's dentist, who sent me to Senator Ted Kennedy's dentist, who took care of me right away. And that day I had four wisdom teeth, all four of my wisdom teeth removed, with a pack of peas on my cheeks and tea bags in my mouth to keep from getting dry socket. And I showed up at work the next day with my frozen peas.
Extraordinary thing is that one of your colleagues, you told her about the story and she discovered exactly the same, grinding her teeth.
Yes, grinding her teeth. She, too, had had tooth pain, and I sent her to Dr. Gutenberg straight away, and she had her wisdom teeth taken out the following week.
Now, you talk about in the book about the lessons that you've learned, and it's a very good practical primer for those who are in any job, never mind mm-hmm. Politics, but you talk about preparedness, and that can be anything from packing Imodium and Xanax in your luggage, or you say red wine, except you can't really pack that for foreign trips.
Yes.
And you mentioned earlier preparing for a dinner conversation with strangers, you mm-hmm. find out as much as you can, so you've got something to talk about. But yet, on your wedding, you've got a problem. He has a gift for you, you don't have a gift for him, and you're asked by the judge, what vows would you like, and you haven't a clue.
I said, well, it's actually even worse than not having a clue. There I was, in my blue dress, being married by Justice Kagan at the Supreme Court. I was so lucky that she agreed to do that, so we didn't have to go to the DMV, in City Hall and get married, basically. And she said, have you thought about what vows you would like? And I said, what are our options? And she showed me several options, and I said, I want the shortest. And my to-be husband was aghast, and I realized that's not the nicest thing to say. But we did, and she had, it was amazing, they decorated it for us. And, you know, when it was all over, I had a glass of champagne, and I felt more like myself. But, you know, getting married is stressful no matter how you do it, apparently.
Well, your whole time spent in politics, and particularly in the White House, is a story of highs and lows and stress. And mm-hmm. eventually, stress really does begin to affect your health.
Yeah.
And Obama, who's great, he just says, no, you don't need to leave the White House. Just take a vacation.
Yes. And the thing is, when you are in the White House, there is really no vacation. Even the best intentioned people who would want to go away and just get away from it, it's just very, very hard. And I think that, again, with this sort of output of this current administration, it seems like such a sideshow that people didn't understand. I think that I worry that people will forget sort of, you know, the work ethic of past administrations, all of them, you know. And for us, it was that. I mean, I will never forget. It was my second summer there, and some girlfriends and I had decided to go to Greece for a vacation. And so we were in Greece. The chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, was in Montana. Several other people in and around the White House were scattered on vacation, and we all had to get on a conference call to talk about the oil spill that was in the Gulf of Mexico. And so you really never escape it. We were hiking in Santorini, and we had to stop and get shade under a rock to be able to take the call. And so, you know, even though we tried, taking a break isn't realistic, and you give it everything you can give. And I think that for anybody who was in that position, they gave 110%. And when I started feeling like I was giving 100% or 95%, I thought, you know, in every relay, you need a set of fresh legs. And so I genuinely thought it was time for a set of fresh legs in my job.
It's interesting you were in Santorini, and there's an oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, which will blacken the sands. And you're mm-hmm. on the island of volcanic black sand.
So, yes, exactly.
A kind of pathetic fallacy, as they would have it. Leaving the White House at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. Now, there are so many anecdotes of the kindness of Barack Obama, the informality. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the Senate, you called him Barack, but in public, Mr. Senator or Senator, whatever, the formality.
Yes.
But the informality in the White House. It seems that in spite of all the hard work, it was an absolutely brilliant place to be and a great president to be around.
I mean, I am so lucky, and it is also part of what prompted me to share my experience, is that I wanted everyone to know that the image that they had of Barack Obama and Michelle Obama as these sort of wonderful, thoughtful, you know, intellectually curious people was 100% true. And if it weren't true, I never would have written the book, because who would want to write a book of lies? But to me, it was important that everybody know that they are who we wanted them to be and who we thought they were. And I thought that was important.
And the leaving of the White House, mm-hmm. tears on the shoulder of Uncle Joe Biden.
Yes.
And a fond farewell. It must have been so difficult, you know, mixed feelings. You know, you have to go for your own sanity. But also you're leaving, you know, just coming towards the end of the adventure.
Well, you know, you realize the one thing that I think all of us tried to do was be present and try to take in the moments as they happened. You know, you can't take them all in. But I did. I would know when I was in something or someplace that was very special, and I would try to take a photograph in my brain. And the day that I was leaving, I was almost like a zombie. You know, I was going through all the motions of shutting down so much that Dan Pfeiffer, who was actually taking my office when I left, I had all of the painters and wall hangers come and switch over his office so I could decorate it for him, because I knew he would never do it. And it was done before I even left that day. And I kept it together. I was, you know, sunshine and light and, you know, skipping around, saying goodbye to people. And then the very last thing you do before you leave the White House is you hand over your badge that has your security clearance on it. And you get read out, quote unquote, read out by the by the security folks. And that basically means that they explain to you that any classified information that you have seen or been around is no longer yours to share, that it's a violation to share classified information, blah, blah, blah. And as I hand over my badge, I just started sobbing at my desk because I realized that by giving the badge back, I would never be able to come back in, you know, of my own free will. And that was the moment that it all really hit me. And we had the president and first lady had a lovely party out on the patio off the Oval Office for me. And when I went to go leave, Dan Pfeiffer walked me out and we just started crying. I mean, we had grown up together, you know, basically. And I got into my car and I turned on Led Zeppelin really loud. And for the last time, I drove out the gates onto Pennsylvania Avenue and off to my house to get ready for my going away party. But it was like a scene from The West Wing in my head, you know, the driving out. And I thought to myself, someday, for some reason, I will need to recreate this situation, this scene. But no, that was a, it was very, to me, it was almost cinematic.
One last thing. You might never even have gotten into the White House because you were a self-confessed dope smoker.
Yes, I love pot. I believe in the health benefits and the healing powers of cannabis, marijuana, and it was something that for many years, and to me it was a very interesting discovery, that for all of the years I had smoked pot, you know, I didn't go to work stoned, you know, just a little bit before you go to bed, but for all of those years I slept like a baby, my stress was low, and then you have to stop taking it because you go to the White House, and of course, because I never thought this pot should be illegal, well, what I think doesn't really matter to the FBI because it was in fact illegal, and I had to explain to them when they wanted me to put a number of how many times I had smoked pot that that would be impossible because I couldn't possibly have kept track, and they were aghast. But the thing about it is, because I was so open, in the White House we call it open kimono, about my drug use, that they knew that I wasn't lying and therefore couldn't be blackmailed. So I had to be randomly drug tested every couple of weeks for a year. But it is the thing that Jared Kushner is going through right now, is that he didn't put it all down on the form. And one thing that we were always told is more is better in this case. And so I overshared with the FBI. And I am glad that the movement to legalize pot is sweeping across the country.
Well, the effect of what you did on yourself is vividly told in the book. But I'm wondering, when you look at what you went through in those days and looking at today's White House, I mean, if you were organized chaos in the Obama White House, they have in the Trump White House disorganized chaos, it would seem. Do you ever feel for the people in there, the functionaries who are trying to get through the day?
Oh, deeply. Deeply, because the one thing that when we were transitioning in 08 and 09, the Bush folks said that these people, these very people that, you know, Donald Trump has sort of discredited, you know, as Obama people when they weren't, they're what are called career employees. They're there from administration to administration, and they are the reason that the peaceful transition of power can occur, because there is never a point in which the government stops functioning. And so I feel very sad for those folks, especially all of the Foreign Service workers in the State Department who, you know, without proper daily briefings, have no information to share and are rendered sort of, you know, useless. So I am pulling for them, and I am hoping that there is a course correction in the Trump administration, and they start really valuing those people who have dedicated their lives to the, you know, public service in the U.S.
Well, the book is brilliant. It's called Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? And Other Questions You Should Have Answered To When You Work in the White House. It's published by Little Brown. It'll be out on August the 3rd, priced around €20. And its author, Alyssa Mastromonaco, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much.